The following recording of Ram Dass, entitled Why Suffering, was made in Devon, England, in July of 1994.
What I want to talk about the first evening, I remember I talked about awakening and then the kind of ascent and descent and getting the integration together of the planes of consciousness, of awareness, and then the daily life existence, psychosocial, physical psychosocial planes, and integrating these. And then yesterday I talked about it going the other way, of the awareness coming into form and then the awakening and the awakening back into awareness. So it was coming down and up again. Now, one of the sticking points in the spiritual journey is the relation, as we've talked about getting high and being free, that for me in 1974 or 5, I really fully realized my predicament. I had now been on the journey for about 15 years. And when I spiritually started to awaken, the Eastern models that were available to me were basically renunciate models. They were basically rooted in the assumption that the desire systems on the physical, psychological plane were so powerful and one was addicted to them so strongly that the only way to start to tune to these quieter, deeper other planes of consciousness was to remove oneself from the environments in which the worldly desire systems were operative. So therefore, if you could go into a cave or go to an ashram, and in the ashram there was celibacy and there was lack of spicy foods, and there was lack of social interplay, and there were no advertising things, and you didn't read the newspapers, and you didn't listen to the radio, and you just pulled yourself back from the kind of panoply of worldly desires in order to quiet down enough to hear these other planes of consciousness. And you get incredibly high under those conditions. I mean, energies and I'm doing a tremendous amount of kundalini or energy work with my breath, the energy was just, I was like wired and slept very little and had so much light coming out of my head and so on. And the predicament that I finally recognized, which those of you that know my material have heard me talk about this a lot, was that the Buddhist doctrine that the cause of suffering is the attraction and the aversion in the mind, that even though I was high and really out there and in bliss and rapture, there was still inherent in that situation suffering. The reason was because there was an aversion to the physical, worldly, psychological stuff. That is, I had gotten high through pushing it away. And I didn't really want to have commerce with it. People come to me and they used to come to me and they'd say, I live in the mountains because the cities really bring me down. And they'd say, could you give me a spiritual practice? And before 74, I would say, well, meditate more deeply, do more pranayama and stuff. After 74, I'd say, go live in the city. Because I began to see that the pushing away of the world was a stance, and that that stance made me frightened of that world. Frightened that it would undercut my high. It would undercut my feeling of spiritual connectedness. And so around the middle 70s, I really did an about-face. And some of you remember much later, when I met my disembodied friend Emmanuel, and I said to Emmanuel, through the woman who is the channel for him, I said, "Emmanuel, what am I doing on this plane? Who made this error? I mean, why am I in the world? I'm much too pure for this." And he said, "Ram Dass," he said, "you're in school. Why don't you try taking the curriculum?" And it really did. That was just one of the reason I bring him up, is because that way of stating it was extremely useful to me, because I began to look at my life situation as a curriculum that was designed in order to help me awaken and become free. It's Jesus on the main line. Now, the predicament with coming back and facing the world is that when you have opened a lot spiritually and then turn and look at the world, what you are aware of is the absolute immensity of the suffering that is inherent in existing in form. And for most of us, the way we deal in our daily lives with the suffering that exists in the world, the fact that there are so many billions of people at this moment whose stomachs lack proper food and nourishment, who are hungry. I mean, how do we deal with it? We're sitting here having had a wonderful breakfast, and we're dealing with our brothers and sisters who are starving. And some of us have money in the bank, and these people are still starving. And we are part of a web of a situation that is creating suffering. We can say, "Oh, they did it to themselves," but we know that that's fraudulent. That's not the way it is. We're part of conditions that have suffering inherent within them. Now, most of us deal with that through devices of denial, through turning away, through hardening. What we do is we armor our hearts. We veil our hearts with our minds. We have rationalizations. "Well, I can't do anything about it," or "I gave at the office," or whatever we do, to give ourselves the feeling we can go on in the presence of this suffering and function. And very few of us fully appreciate the cost of that. The cost of that kind of armoring of the heart. Because the nature of... Let's see how to say this. That you and I as entities, just like our intellects are fed by ideas, our spirit or intuitive heart is fed by a boundless interaction with that which is around us, where there are no boundaries. You could call it love, you could call it presence, you could call it isness. There are a lot of words they don't describe, they just point at it. But you can tell, you know yourself, that when you love something, when you love a rose, or you love another person, or you love a beauty, or you love, you know how it feeds you, the way in which love feeds you. And it feeds each other in a loving relationship. And so you can say, "I can love her or him But I can't love them because I can't afford to, because that's too much suffering for me. The cost of doing that veiling means that you protect your heart, and it feels protected and less vulnerable, but it is also very deadened in the process. There's no longer the kind of living spiritual interchange of energy that comes from being in love in the universe. And I think people go around, most people go around, running on about one or two cylinders out of their eight or something. And they have cut themselves off, and they live, the veil of the heart is the mind. And they have veiled themselves with thought, which makes them feel safe, but also cuts down the juice, the feeding of the spirit. And I don't know how to say, the feeding of the spirit isn't quite the right term, but you have a sense of what I'm trying to talk about. But it seems very difficult to conceive of how you would deal with the immensity of the suffering without closing down your heart. How could you bear it? How can you bear what is basically unbearable? I mean, the immensity of the suffering, and you don't have to go to the poor. You can look at the rich. Look at the lines in their faces. Look at the tension. Look at the panic. Look at people that are involved in any of the economic systems of the world at the moment. Look at the fear that is generated by the instability of these systems, and you will see tremendous suffering everywhere. And you'll see people buying things to make themselves happy and then not being happy with the thing they bought, and that's forms of suffering. Getting what they wanted is a suffering. Isn't that funny? Getting old is suffering because it's all changing and your body is getting ill and failing, and that's all can be suffering. Dying is suffering. These are all can be sufferings. We're going to talk about that in a minute. So that the issue is, how do you respond to the immensity of the suffering around you in a way that doesn't close you down? In which you don't have to use your mind in order to protect your heart. That seems to me to be the issue that I find at the root of why people find the world scary. Because they will get overwhelmed by the suffering around them, their own and everybody else's. I mean, in the United States now, in any major city, in Los Angeles or New York or San Francisco, you are constantly, when you're walking through the main part of town, walking over homeless people that are living in doorways that are... Now, you're used to it in India. If you live in Calcutta, half the population's living like that. And everybody... But in the United States, the affluent United States, it seems bizarre that people are... Some people are living so well and some people are living so badly, and we can't get the system together to have enough equity to give everybody at least shelter and food and clothing. And if you look at the faces of the people that are walking by, the homeless people who are begging, you can see the cost of the turned offness. You can just see it. Now, to get to the answer to how I deal with this, because I'll tell you in advance that I deal with this by cultivating more than one plane of consciousness. that is that through the practices and the metaphysical study and the kind of experiences in these other realms of consciousness, when I come into a perceptual vantage point in which I look at a leaf or a drop of water or stars, planets, and I see the extraordinarily exquisite and awesome nature of the lawful relationships of phenomena, one to another, and I can find that law, different kinds of laws, but the same law, the same Tao, the same way of things, I can find that in music, I can find it in genetics, in chemistry, I can find it in each field that I attend to. And one, it can't help but be filled with awe at the magnificence of the way it all works. And then one realizes within that, that the way it all works includes suffering. And you can say, well, it's all perfect except for the suffering. If it weren't for suffering, everything would be perfect. But when you look at the way in which the formless comes into form, it starts out with two. It starts out with positive and negative energy. If you don't have positive and negative charge, you don't start manifestation in form. It starts out with dark and light. If you don't have dark and light, you don't have discrimination in form. Then you've got good and evil. You've got all the polarities. The minute you open the door to polarity, the minute you go from one to two, you open to all the polarities. And the universe, the universe of matter, of form, of all form, is rooted in two. Before two, there's one, and with one, there's no manifestation. So, and then I say, and this is partly rationalization, it's partly my intellect playing, that the people that, like my guru and the people, the mystics that I've come in contact with, who I know are wide open to what is in the world, look at suffering differently than I look at it. And I see that my perception is defined by my identification with me as a physical, psychological entity. That colors what I'm able to see of the mystery of the universe. And that coloring awakens in me empathy and generates in me fear when I am in the presence of so much suffering. And I see that when I read the words of the masters, spiritual masters, when I plumb the depths of mysticism as best as my light will allow, there are moments when I feel that the mystery has an inherent wisdom in it that my rational, linear, analytic mind cannot understand, cannot grok, it cannot handle it, because my intellectual, analytic, judging, rational mind is a subsystem within a metasystem. And those of you that understand logic know that a subsystem cannot subsume a metasystem under it. So I am faced with a predicament that the tool that I have developed, which is my analytic mind, is inadequate to the task of understanding the nature of suffering. And all I can end up doing with my mind is judging it and judging God and saying, somehow somebody screwed up badly. Instead of saying, maybe I don't understand. Now, so you can hear that that's partly rationalization of the mind, but it's rooted in something very deep that is very true in my being. And I've given the example that some of you have found as outrageous as I did when it first happened. When I was in India in 1971, second time I was there, there was tremendous devastation in Bangladesh. And I had a Volkswagen microbus, and I wanted to use it as an ambulance and go over and help. And it turned out, had I gone, it wouldn't have worked. I mean, there were miles of cars and nothing happened, and the gas ran out and everything. But at the time, I was so upset about the plight of these people that I was distraught. And I went to my guru to get his blessings to go with my car to do this. And he wouldn't stop me. I mean, he wouldn't do anything. He said, of course, if you desire, do what you want. But he said, then he was quiet for a minute. He said, Ram Dass, he said, don't you see it's all perfect? And I remember, here I love this man so deeply, but I remember feeling as if this was an obscenity. That he had just said something obscene to me. How could he say the children starving to death was perfect? How could he say it? How could he even conceive of it? Now, he wasn't saying that it didn't stink. He wasn't saying it wasn't awful. He was saying, with all that, he said, what he was saying to me was, and he was a person of incredible compassion that I knew. I mean, I've watched him cry many times. He fed everybody he could. He did what he could all the time. What he was saying is, Ram Dass, you've lost your balance. You're out of balance. And the balance is the balance of planes of consciousness. The balance is getting so obsessed with the suffering that you end up railing against the unknown organization of it all, even though your mind can't understand it. It's like saying, I assume the mystery is a failure. But you don't know that. It's a mystery. And there is... Now, I could see immediately that one could use, oh, it's all perfect, like it's all karma, as a rationalization for not acting. And we're not talking about the cheap cop-out. That is not what we're dealing with here. We're dealing with where one can stand in one's awareness that allows one to be in the presence of what is in the universe without closing the heart. Because if you close or armor the heart in order to be in the universe, you have become a crippled instrument for the healing of the universe. So the exercise is, how do you keep your heart open in hell, basically? Because it is a hell of suffering, if you look at it that way. Now, part of it has to do with the fear of the vulnerability of the breaking heart. My heart will break. My heart is breaking. Remember, I wrote a letter to a couple whose daughter had just, with her girlfriend, had gone to play tennis, her 11-year-old daughter, and had been raped and murdered. And I just couldn't conceive of the anguish and pain that these parents were feeling of. And yet I had to write a letter. I had to do something because they were people that were connected. And I said, there's very little I could say that would deal with your anguish. And I said, you are being forced to bear the unbearable. And when you are forced to bear the unbearable, something dies in you. What dies in you is who you were that couldn't bear the unbearable. Because there it is. There's the unbearable. And you say, unbearable to whom? Unbearable to who I think I am. And in order to preserve who I think I am, you armor yourself against the unbearable. You're bearing the unbearable. That is the root of the deepest compassion in the world. That's where compassion comes from. You're being turned into an instrument of compassion. It's a very fierce lesson. And neither of us, neither I nor your daughter would give it to you, but there it is. That's the legacy. That's what you're getting from this. And if you look, if you individually look at your own suffering in this life, whatever kind of sufferings you've had, sufferings of isolation, of inadequacy, of failure, of loss, of grief, they've hurt like hell. If you've been open, your heart has broken. But here you are. Here you are. And some of you, I am sure, can see the way in which that suffering burned deep into you and created in you a different quality of your own being. And it's very hard to imagine a system, a curriculum that is designed in which Suffering 102 is part of the coursework for becoming a full human being. Now, as I said, there's a tremendous fear of the vulnerability to your human heart. I can't bear it. I've got to look away. Many of us had the experience when we were, some of us still are, but very young, of having our first love affairs, our first intense attachments, and having them go awry, and having our hearts broken, and thinking, I'll never open my heart again. It's too painful. A few didn't, but most of us, after a while, after we grieved for our loss, something turned and we were ready again to start again. And many of us have opened our hearts many times and had them broken many times, and we keep growing and growing and growing and growing. And instead of looking at that as the failures of life and the pathology, to look at it as the process of life, just that little flip of consciousness, as the process of your life. I look back on the sufferings of my life, and I may be really weird, but I see them now as gifts. I wouldn't have asked for them in a second. I hated them while I was having them. I protested as loudly as I could, but they happened anyway. And now, in retrospect, as I look back, I now see the way in which they deepened my being immeasurably. Now, there's an interesting distinction that's important to make here. In the noble truths that the Buddha enunciated, he talks about suffering being inherent in the way of things, and then he talks about the end of suffering. And he points out that the cause of the suffering of an individual has to do with the way in which their mind responds to phenomena.
Please flip the tape over at this point to begin side B.